What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Cirque du Soleil. This week, our guest is Chad Frazier. Chad and I had talked for a while before we started the show today, and just an amazing story, amazing wealth of knowledge and willingness to share. So let me start off by saying, if you want to talk to Chad, or if you want your AT program to talk to Chad, you want your sports medicine students to hear from Chad, then let them know. Get a hold of them, and just amazingly willing to share. And again, he was talking with my students right here before the show, and that's some good information for them as well. So definitely at the end, we'll give you the Chad's contact information, so get a hold of him. I am Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I got my students here with me, and then, of course, Chad Frazier. And on Skype is Sean Reedy. Sean, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
There we go. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/CIRQ. So that's CIRQUE, as in Cirque du Soleil. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/CIRQ. Chad, we talked about your background. You did 2 years as a massage therapist, athletic therapist, because you're from Canada.
Correct.
And then you did 2 years in your master's in Virginia, and then you did 11 years in college sports. Is that right? 7 years in college sports.
Seven years after my graduate work.
All right. So tell me a little bit more about that, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Canada. I'm from a small town on the east coast of Canada, a little town in Nova Scotia. I was an athlete my whole life. So, and then when I started to get hurt, I was just more curious about what was going on with my body. I was able to become a student therapist while I was in my undergrad. I had a great mentor, Tara Sutherland. And so she took me under her wing, and I really realized that that was something that I really wanted to do more. So pursued a master's in education and sports medicine down at Old Dominion University in Virginia, and then decided to stay in the area. Really loved the Norfolk, Newport News, Virginia Beach area, and stayed there for 7 years working at a Division III university there, and just absolutely had a fantastic experience there. And then decided I wanted to try something a little bit different, wanted to be closer to my family, decided to move back to Canada. And that's how Cirque came about.
All right. So you said the Cirque headquarters was there, and you tried out just being there at the Cirque office for a year. And then they said, hey, you're doing really awesome. Let's bring you on the show. And then take it from there.
Yeah. So the position actually at first was a permanent position at the headquarters. The IHQ headquarters is in Montreal. That's where Cirque du Soleil was born. And it was just kind of working with a lot of the artists that were trying to break into Cirque du Soleil. So it was almost kind of like a training camp that they would do. Then there was a show that was starting that was scheduled to premiere in 2012. So this was in the fall of 2011 that I started. They needed somebody to kind of be the liaison for all the information, all the artists coming in. I took on that role and absolutely had a great time. In doing so, really built a rapport with the members of the show, the coaches, the administrators, all the artists. And then they said, look, we need a therapist to go on tour. Is that something that you'd be interested in? So talked it over with my wife and my family, because the whole idea of getting closer to the family was to not be traveling as much like I was doing at university. But it was a great opportunity, great tour plan, decided I would try it for a year. And now 6 years later, I'm still touring because I still love it.
All right. And you were also telling me the tour plan, the schedule. You said your wife gets to come out to every city, but what does that currently look like? And I know you said here in Houston, you were here 7 weeks.
Correct.
And are all of them that same length?
No, it all differs. So right now, we're on a North American tour. So we're in our fourth year of that North American tour. Generally, we're in a city between 6 and 10 weeks. We're in large markets, so a lot of major cities. So 10 weeks we'll do sometimes like Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, and some smaller areas like in DC, at Dallas, we do 5-6 weeks. We did 7 weeks here in Houston. So we're going to be going to some smaller markets in Canada following this, which will only be 5 and 4 weeks respectively, because it's the first time they've had the big top 10. So it really varies, but it's just great to be in a city for a while. You feel like you live there because you're there for an extended amount of time. You get to learn all about the cool things that are offered in the city. And then right around the time that you're starting to get a little antsy, you move on to the next one.
All right. So one of Sean's questions he wanted to ask there was, what's your favorite thing to do when you travel? So you came to Houston, you just said you get to explore and see all the city. So what's your favorite thing to look for and do?
So for me, I'm a runner. That's my thing. I find it's a great way to explore a city because you really get to see everything. So for me, when I was in Houston, I discovered the Bayou Park right around under the overpass. I do a 6 mile run. Usually on my days off, I'll go there. I'm heading there tomorrow to do it. So I just love to find areas that I can run and explore, see some old historic buildings, anything like that. Just good visual stuff. That's what I really enjoy doing.
Very good, Sean.
Did so I kind of creeped on your Instagram a little bit and saw that I'm pretty jealous that you got to go out to the training to Becca Boyd's place, and I saw that you do a little bit of CrossFit. Is that something that you stop in and drop into places and do that while you're traveling too?
Yeah, so I started CrossFit myself probably about 2 years ago. I have a great gym that I train at in Montreal. So the acrobats that we work with, a lot of those guys, they like to do a lot of supplemental training and really do extra things. So we had some guys that really wanted to challenge themselves a little bit more. So we oversee all the medical stuff, but I also oversee a little bit of the strength and conditioning. So I would take them through some functional training exercises and workouts in the tent and said, hey, if you guys are ever interested in doing something like this, we can actually try going to a CrossFit gym. So we did that when we our first city in Calgary in Alberta, and then I just started doing it in all the cities that we went through. So when we were in Los Angeles, I follow CrossFit a lot. I contacted Becca Voigt because her gym was right close to where we were staying, and she was a Cirque fan as well. So getting to train under one of the top CrossFit athletes around has been fantastic. Camille LeBlanc-Bazinet was the fittest woman in the world in 2014. She's a fellow Canadian. She came out to see the show. When we were in Chicago, she was visiting. Noah Olson, another big CrossFitter from Miami, he came out to see the show. So what I found is that so many people enjoy Cirque du Soleil. So if we can share the worlds that we're in, I love to show them how we train and get ready for things. And it's great for the acrobats and myself to be a part of that as well.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So on that, what was what Jeremy had said to you about some of my questions, what is your favorite thing that you've ever got to go and see and or cut to go and do when you're in a different city?
Okay, well, I'd say there's probably, just from a visual thing, the three things that stand out are the first time I ran across the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. I mean, that's an iconic thing. Mm-hmm. Also ran up on top to behind the Hollywood sign when we were in L.A. And then running through Central Park in New York. Like, those are things that I grew up seeing in movies all the time and just such iconic symbols of things that are amazing. But one of the things that stands out is when we were in Atlanta, I'm a huge fan of the show American Ninja Warrior. And I got a chance to actually test the course before they filmed it in Atlanta and actually got to connect with one of the guys who had shoulder surgery. I took over his rehab to get him ready to go back to the show. So that's Ryan Stratus, still a good friend of mine. I follow him all the time. And because I got him ready for the show, he actually invited me to Vegas. I got to go to the Vegas finals and run the sideline of the course with him as his guest. So just being part of that to see some of the ninjas, it was absolutely an amazing experience and something that I'll remember forever.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
I've always wanted to do that. I think that's really cool.
they make it look so easy, and that when you're up there, when you're testing the course, you realize how far that water is of a drop. It is intimidating. And I brought a couple of the acrobats out to test with us, and some of the guys did fantastic. But it's, you know, you have like 40 or 50 producers watching you go through it, and they're like, all right, go. And everyone's just watching you. It's not even on TV yet, but it's quite intimidating. But it was an experience for sure.
So obviously, how well did you do?
Well, I only did a couple of the obstacles because they do it one at a time. So I did a couple of them. I didn't do too bad. I stayed dry, but I also made sure I selectively chose the obstacles that I was doing. One of our guys, he did a fantastic. He actually did the first four obstacles right up until the warped wall, until he ended up falling through it. But he did one of the best of any of the testers. So I was proud of him that I brought one guy that did quite well.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So one of my kids asked earlier, are you flexible like the athletes, right? And so when we talked to Dina from San Antonio Fire Department, they put her into that equipment. She had to be up on a ladder and do that kind of training. What is your experience with those type of acrobatic or athletic events that your performers are doing?
Got it. Well, to answer the first question, no, I'm not super flexible like the artists. I work on my flexibility, but nothing to that level. It really depends on the apparatus. There are some things that I'm capable to do what I would consider as an athletic person. But obviously we have contortionists in our show. There's no way I'm ever getting to that level at all. But we have an act in our show, which is called the Acronet, which is essentially a huge, like 30 or probably 40 by 40 foot trampoline. And Sean, you saw the show, so you know what I'm talking about. So I got the opportunity to get on that. And for that, I like to be able to be on there so that I can get an appreciation of how the body feels and how the body reacts on it. So that if an artist is telling me something that they're feeling, I understand what that's like. On my previous show, there was another, like a Chinese pole. So it's kind of like just like a pole, but it's got some rubber so you can has a bit of a grip to it. I would try that and train on that a little bit. So anything that I have the opportunity to get on, and then the show is okay to do that. Obviously, I need to be safe because I can't be getting hurt doing that kind of stuff. But it really helps me to understand the biomechanics of how these artists move and then how they injure themselves. And the artists are always so open to be able to share their knowledge of it. And that really helps me to understand in guiding rehab and in looking at steps for how they get back quicker. So they've always been really supportive of that.
All right, one of Sean's questions was, as you're dealing with people from all over the world in your shows, how are you communicating with language barriers?
Yeah, so we have 15 countries represented from our artists, which is amazing. And some of the artists don't speak fantastic English. But on tour, the language on tour is English. So the artists are expected to have a certain level of comprehension to be able to communicate with us. And essentially, they really want it to be for if you're hurt, to be able to say what you need. We're fortunate enough to have some of the Russian artists or Eastern European artists that don't speak English. They speak some sort of dialect of Russian. And our head coach is Russian, so I could use him as for translation if necessary. We have a few artists, one from Colombia, a few from Spain, that speak Spanish and don't speak a lot of English. One of our stage managers and one of our people in wardrobe also speak Spanish, so that I can use them in a pinch. But so many of the artists have been on tour for so long that they have the ability to communicate because they've toured all over the world longer than I have. So they're always able to be able to tell me when they have something wrong with them.
How does that go with? Oh, sorry. How does that go with? It's a different type of performance. I mean, it's not in the world of athletics where we have to win. Like we have to win to go on to the next one. Mm-hmm. We have to win to go on to the next one. It's performance. You have to be able to do this every day to be able to do your job. So it's not like I have to go out and put out my all today. It's kind of I have to go out and put everything into it that I have to. And then be able to do it again tomorrow. So how does that mentality a little bit differentiate between, you know, the athletes that you worked when you were at Old Dominion or at any of these different schools mm-hmm. in comparison to the performers that you're working with today?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's something that I talk a lot about this when I speak to students about this, that at the end of the day, these artists, they love what they do and they always want to be doing it. So there are times when their bodies are not at the greatest health or they're coming back from an injury and they want to go back on stage because they love that feeling of the crowd giving them that applause. And they just love sharing their craft with anybody, like anybody who competes or does anything at a high level. But what I was telling Jeremy before is that unlike in traditional sport, every day is our game day. Every show we want to be the best. So sometimes knowing that the athlete is really important of saying, yes, I'm sure you could probably do it, but you're going to be dealing with something for a little bit longer if we continue to push. So why don't we rest a little bit, make some modifications, and then we'll get you back to 100% quicker. And having that rapport, and that's one of the things I think ATs are so great at, is having that really good rapport with their athletes or their artists, whatever setting you're in, and really knowing them and having that trust of being able to say, it's not that you don't have the desire. I know you do. And I know that you probably could do it. But let's look at this for the long term, that we want you to be a good employee for a longer amount of time to be able to continue to do what you do for a run. The artists always want to be healthy for premiere, you know, if they have guests in the audience or anything like that. But everyone that's there every night, they pay their money. They want to see the best possible show. So we do the best that we can to really make the artists understand that we want you to be on stage, but we want you to be your best self. And I've been fortunate enough because of the way I approach it, never really had any pushback from any artists. And the administrators and our artistic director, our coaches, they know that I'm looking out for the best interests of the artist and as well for the show. So it's worked out really well.
All right. So in that, you're looking for long-term health, long run for your athletes. What is one of your favorite tools to prevent injury?
So for me, what I've used a lot lately is just my biggest tool is my eyes. I just love to watch them train. I love to watch them practice. Because I've seen them so train so often for so long, I've been with the show from the very beginning. We've done almost, we're coming close on 1,200 shows that I've watched them so much, I can tell when those little differences are there. So if I see something that looks a little different, I'm talking to them as soon as they're off stage or as soon as they're done with their training or their practice, saying, you know, I'm noticing something a little different. How are you feeling? And if they give me that information, oh, well, I'm feeling a little tight. All right, well, let's look on something. Let's get ahead of something before it becomes another thing. Another thing that we utilize is I film a lot. I'll use my phone. I'll just film some of their tricks, especially things that are quick or that with a lot of spinning or with speed. And I'll film it in slow motion, and then we'll go through it together. So then they're able to break it down from an acrobatic standpoint of, oh, I like how this looks. And then I can look at it biomechanically and start to break down things if I see something. And then the three of us, the head coach, the artist, myself, we can talk about it. Hey, it looks like maybe your low back, you're favoring this a little bit. Maybe we can do a little bit of prevention work. So that's what I think is the biggest tool, is just really watching the sport or the craft or whatever it is you're doing. Because the more information you can take in, the better off you can serve your athlete.
I know in a previous episode we talked about technology. Do you ever use like Huddle or Coach's Eye, or you just use your iPhone and slow it down?
We actually use Dartfish. So it's something. But the beauty about Dartfish is that you can upload it from a phone, or we have the show camera that records the show. We live record all of our shows, so the artists can record it, break it down in speed. We can overlay. We can do strobe effects. It's pretty pretty impressive how the technology is improving, and it's only going to just help people prevent injuries and come back quicker and increase their productivity.
All right.
How would you educate somebody on that? I mean, that's a different biomechanical pattern. That's some of the, like the contortion is something that we're not supposed to do. Some of those movements are stuff that, you know, like you said, when we kind of chatted, there's five people in the world that knows how to do this. So this is pretty special. How have you kind of mentally prepared yourself and put yourself into that situation to where you're able to break that biomechanical movement pattern down?
Well, I think what it comes down to is that we also don't want to, if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, like a lot of these artists, like I was telling the students here, that they've been doing it sometimes since they were 7 years old. So what I kind of urge people to do, especially in this field, is don't think of everything has to be perfect the way that we think the gold standard of biomechanical movement is. Because you can see somebody that can do something, like we said, only a handful of people in the world can do this at such a high level. Who am I to just say, no, you're doing this wrong. We need to do it this way. That's really not what it's about. It's more, for me, it's about, I analyze it. If I see something that I think could present a problem medically, then I bring it to the head coach who has, you know, 20 plus years of experience acrobatically, and the artist, and say, well, are you having any pain with this? Are you having any problems? If they're not having any problems, they're not missing a show, and they're operating at a high level, okay, well, then that's something that we can just move forward on. We don't need to worry about. If I start to see something that looks like it could present a problem, and then they're also saying, yeah, I'm having some discomfort, then I think that's when we need to really act. And if it's something that they've been doing for so long and it's continuously causing a problem, then we really just need to work with the coach and the artist to retrain how their body moves. And then we can do that through, you know, prevention, body awareness, postural, all those type of things. And then it goes back to all the tools that you have in your tool belt as a therapist, of being able to just help that artist get to where they want to do. So yeah, you can do what you're looking for, but you can do it safely and extend their career. So in traditional sports, sometimes it's like, oh, you know, you want to win a championship, or you're a four-year athlete in university, and then you're never playing it again. These artists in my field, they want to do this as long as they can. They want to do it sometimes into their 40s. I have an artist who's 42, one of our high-level acrobats. So if I can add 2-3 years onto his career, that's more money in his pocket to take care of his family and to continue to do the things he loves to do. So ultimately, it's just looking at what the artist is giving you visually, and then having that conversation of, all right, what do we act on and what do we not? Does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Obviously, we all, as athletic trainers, know general treatments. We know how to stretch. You know, most of us know how to foam roll or do some sort of soft tissue mobilization. What are some very unique treatments you've had to use?
Well, we don't really reinvent the wheel that much, but one of the things that we've done is trying to look at doing either release or strengthening in functional positions. So one of the one interesting thing I'll talk about is the Russian cradle, stuff that we had talked about, Sean. So Russian cradle is an act where, essentially, if you've ever done a kettlebell swing, it's like this guy just does a huge kettlebell swing with a human being who happens to be, you know, almost 100 pounds, and he throws and catches her around. So obviously, if you think about from a flyer, their arms are extended, they're hanging from hand to hand and being swung around. A lot of traction, a lot of forces on that shoulder. So if you think about, oh, well, we're just going to strengthen the rotator cuff. That's, you know, oh, low-hanging fruit, easy. But what I in learning about this discipline, the shoulders have to be loose and lax in order to be able to get that full range. That's what I've learned. So what we've done is we've almost started to do some rotator cuff strengthening with the shoulder in full traction overhead, which by normal standards you wouldn't do, but it helps to strengthen those tendons in a more functional range for her because she spends her entire act with her arms overhead with traction force. So we always talk about, you know, packing that shoulder joint in to do it for rotator cuff, but that's not her reality. So we had to kind of change our thinking and say, all right, well, we want to strengthen the rotator cuff, but we also can't allow it to be close. So what do we do? So we just started to kind of play with that and figure out, all right, well, what if we just have you do some band work with you completely extended overhead, doing internal external rotation, now we can establish some of that strengthening. So it's just a matter of just having the ability to sit back and say, all right, what are we looking for? How can we fix it? And then find something that works.
All right, so describe that a little bit more for me. How do you have somebody in traction and going through range of motion for strengthening exercises?
Yeah. So, yeah, so you, can you see me? Yeah, so if we have her kind of overhead like that, and then we'll have her with a band and then just doing some internal, external like that in that fully flexed position because she is in such full flexion with that that it's almost her joint is almost being pulled a little bit. So rather than kind of being in that position where we keep everything tight into the joint, we're just letting her go out with that band, put a little traction on it, and then start to just bend the elbow a little bit and get that rotator cuff moving a little. Hmm. You know, it's not ideal. Does it fire the rotator cuff as much as we would like? Probably not. But at least it's training those muscles in more of a functional range for her. And we found that that has really helped to increase her strength and helped her to not be out of performance as much.
Something similar. I wonder if swimmers would benefit from exercises like that because they do a lot of overhead movement out here.
Yeah. The only difference with that is they're overhead, but then they quickly move back in. She is almost, and Sean, you can see since you've seen it, but she is in that flex position and she holds there because he's swinging her around the whole time. So for an extended amount of time, probably a good 4 or 5 seconds with a good force, we have a lot of traction on that shoulder joint.
Gotcha. It's literally like they're, you know, when you do that slight traction on your shoulder, on your post-op shoulder patient or something like that, just that overhead traction, just to get a little bit of that light pull, and that range of motion, stuff like that. It is literally like you're yanking both shoulders out. It was crazy. I mean, the athleticism and just what you have to do. I mean, you're not hanging on a bar. You're not hanging on something there where you're getting that light traction there. You're getting the pull and the actual G force, which what I would imagine that I could compare it to, of that whipping action as she flips in the air, and then the guy actually grabs onto her and catches her and has her come down and swing. So it's not that she's like sticking her hand out then to catch onto a bar or a motion there. It's that he literally catches her in the air at the wrists. And I mean, you could see where there would be just, it's like dislocating a shoulder every time that you catch her, you would almost think of. And I mean, it was crazy to watch. So it was nuts. I really enjoyed that one, actually. That was one of my favorite ones for sure. Especially because you could see that, you know, they had to adjust for, in the show that I got to watch, they actually had to adjust a little bit because, you know, it's a live performance and things happen and something happened different. So they had to kind of modify, adjust, and then jump back into it a little bit. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, Sean was saying they had to adjust. You talked to me a little bit about your schedule. You know, you have meetings and you went through this with the group that you said Nova South. The university?
Oh, yeah. Nova Southeastern. Yeah.
Nova Southeastern. So there's an article on AT Today about Chad and their experience there. But you talked about they go through these meetings, you watch the trainings, you see, hey, is there anything we need to scratch or take out of the event? So talk about, I mean, there's so much going on at Cirque du Soleil. And if you've never seen it, then it's really hard to understand. Even with the YouTube video, you missed probably at least half of it watching it on a video because there's so much going on around every direction. But how just the timing seems like if everything isn't exactly the way you train every day, then it's going to be a catastrophe, right? But you just said some things get scratched that day.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, it's live performance. So you can do the best you can to prepare, but there's always going to be some things that change. So what we try to do is, on a typical day, our trainings will start at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for an 8 o'clock show. And then depending on who needs the stage time, so some artists won't have to be there, some will be there. And then we are there from 30 minutes before the first training, much like for any kind of a practice or anything like that. Anybody that has any modification in the show, they have to make sure they check in with us every day. We have what's called a lineup meeting, which is 2 hours and 30 minutes before the show time. So at that point, we lead that meeting of saying, all right, this person is either out, or this person is modified, this is what they can't do. So we say who's in, who's out, who is able to not do something. From there, then the head coach says, okay, well, based on that, then this is the acrobatic show that we have. And then the artistic director, who would be the equivalent of like an athletic director or the head coach for a sports team, they're like, all right, well, then based on that, we're going to do this, this, and this. And then that filters down to all the people in the show, because lighting needs to be aware, sound, rigging, everybody, the band leader, everyone needs to know if there's any modifications. So they need to have enough time to do that. But still, when that happens, sometimes things happen 30 minutes if somebody's warming up right before a show. Something happens. And if we can't scramble to have somebody replace, then it just has to be cut.
The show that I actually got to go see, they actually had to do some cutting of one of the deals. You would have never noticed that it was gone. It was crazy how awesome that it was. And like Chad had said, he goes, I wish you would have been able to see the full event, because you would have not even understood how awesome it was. But we didn't get to see that because they had to adjust there right before. It was like during the opening act, something had happened and they had to adjust for that. But it was still just an amazing talent that they had and a deal that they did. But I mean, we would have never known. And it was crazy how easily they could just kind of slip right into that and let it go.
Yeah. One of the great things about the company is, and the people behind the scenes, they do such a great job of really preparing for things, and they have a binder. It's kind of like a what if. So in that instance that you're talking about, there was an artist who had a spasm right in the middle of one of the first acts. You know, you assess it as quick as possible, because, and that's one of the reasons why I love doing what I do here, because it's fast paced. You're making the decisions, and you know, you have to make those decisions very, very quickly. So it's like, you know, the first thing I'll ask them, or what's the next thing you have to do? So, and then I start to know, all right, do I have 2 minutes? Do I have 4 minutes? Do I have 5 minutes? I have to do that quick assessment to make sure, and then functionally test them, and then make a decision to the stage management of this person's out, or they're going to be doing this, or I need more time. So in that instance, it was a no-brainer. He wasn't able to do what he needed to do. So I'm like, look, he's out of this. And because they would have required to do a validation, they have to cut that part. But we've been on tour with the show now. Like I said, we're in our fourth year. So they know that if this person's out, we just have to cut that part. So for the people that have never seen the show before, to them, it's seamless. They have no idea. You know, but if somebody maybe had seen something on YouTube, or somebody told them about, oh, you got to see this one part, those are the people that you feel bad for, that are expecting something because they're like, oh, I heard about this, and then they don't get to see it. But it's the same as, you know, if you go to a Rockets game and you want to see James Harden and he might not play that day, it's live performance just like that, right? So you hope that you always have the best show, but sometimes you have to pull people for those kind of reasons.
All right, so talk some about the bracing or taping that you might do with these athletes.
So a lot of it is, because on our show, a lot of the costumes cover everything. So taping is not really a problem. I can do anything because their costumes are always going to cover it. If there's anything with feet or hands, we use a lot of the tan PowerFlex, because you just want it to look skin colored. You just don't want to have the illusion that it looks like that you're wearing any type of a bracing. We have one act in our show where it's two guys and they're both shirtless. So if we had any issue with that, that would be a difficult thing. At the end of the day, I can suggest anything medical that could be beneficial, but the artistic director has to give the final green light for that. So if I say, well, this person has to be in a brace or in this taping, and she's like, I don't like how that looks, then we would pull them from the show from that, because it's my job to take care of them medically, but ultimately she presents what she thinks is the best artistic show. And if she's like, oh, I just don't like how that looks, I fully understand that and respect it, but I can't have them go on stage with that because of their injury. And she's like, all right, well, then we just hold them from that. So again, that's a great rapport with the people that you work with. And she has a health science background as well. So she's never, ever fought me on that. And we have a great communication relationship.
one of the questions I have with regard to that is, I know that, like, so me and my girlfriend are always out in Vegas during the national finals in December, and we try and go to a different show. This past year, we actually went to the Zumanity show. So it was interesting, but I was not expecting what I showed up to. But so something I noticed there was some of the tape that was used on that one. And I know that's not your show, but you might be able to answer some of this, where they utilize like a lot of, because their bare skin, mm-hmm. I could see some of the brown tape around the knees. Was that for padding, or would that be to protect the knee? Because it didn't look like it was like a kinesio tape, or it didn't look like it was a type of tape to hold anything structurally. It almost looked like it was more of what you would think of as like pads or volleyball position, so that when they go to slide on their knees, they don't tear up their knees or something like that. Yeah. And obviously they had to go more nude in the color, so that to actually paint it and put it on makeup to match the skin tone. So that was just something I noticed. Can you kind of comment to some of that?
Yeah, and obviously every show is different. And so Zumanity, I can't speak exactly to it since I've never worked with that show. But that is a show. It's kind of more of a sensual show. There is a lot of skin being shown in that show. So it could be either way. Like if there is a lot of movement on stage where there is sliding, and if you're sweating a little bit, having sweaty skin skid on a stage, that would not be very pleasant. So I'm sure that they would either have something to be able to glide more on the stage, or if it has some sort of a dual function of maybe for a little bit of patella or anything like that, or just as a protective thing for their skin, because there's a lot of skin showing in that show for almost the entire time. So it's probably every artist would have an individual thing. Like maybe for their character, they just, I want to be able to slide and be free to move on stage. So I don't want to tear my skin up every time. All right, well, let's just put a little bit of tape around it. And as long as the artistic director is okay with it, that's great. Then both functions are served.
All right, you said that you are the head therapist. And there's two of you that work on this show. And if you have an international tour, you add athletes and then add another therapist. Talk about the way that you handle that relationship with your assistant and the way y'all work together in different roles that y'all have.
Yeah, no problem. So every touring show has two therapists, a head therapist and then a therapist. That exception is when for the Japanese tour, then they add a third therapist, because they'll generally add between 12 to 15 extra therapists. So it's just like any kind of sports medicine staff. For me, I love it to be that we're a team, you know, and while I have a responsibility to answer to things with budgets, all that kind of thing, My therapist, Natalie, we've been together on the show for a year and a half now. I would trust her with this show. If something happened to me, I needed to go away, I know the show is in good hands. She's a very strong therapist, great with the artists. So we do everything hand in hand. I want to know about her cases. I want her to know about the cases that I follow. So there's none of this, oh, well, I need to overlook this because I'm the head therapist. That's really not how we try to operate. We want to make sure that everyone is sharing information and knows what is going on. And it's really worked for us. And that way the artists know that they can come to either of us. We're going to get the same type of care, the same premise of how we deal with the people, and the same values and morals of how we're protecting the show. There's not going to be where one person will allow, okay, well, I'm going to let this slide and go back. No, we're here to serve the artist's health and as well to support the show. And we're always on the same page with that.
All right. On a similar note, you mentioned to me that you were interested in an internship program with CERC, giving athletic trainers an opportunity to work and see what you do and get their foot in the door. How do you see that working out?
Yeah, it's kind of in its infancy stage, because like we had talked about, some of the institutions I've gotten an opportunity to meet with, what I've found is that every time the students come to visit or they hear about what I do, they have so many questions, because they just don't know, well, what is it like? What is there? So I want to expose students to this as an opportunity and as another setting. We all think, when we think of athletic training, you think of the traditional sports setting, which is great. That's how I started. That was what I always wanted to do. But now that I'm in performing arts, I love it. It's great. I love the fast pace of it. So what I'm trying to do is hopefully to establish some sort of internship opportunity. I just don't know. I'm still in the works of trying to see how that's going to kind of blossom and grow. But it really just comes down to the therapists themselves devoting our time to really spend time with students. For me, I had a lot of great mentors when I was a student that really took a lot of time to help me along the way. So it's my way to kind of give back and pay it forward. So whether it's, you know, part of an internship route where, okay, you spend 2 weeks with us on the road, well, not on the road, in the city that we're in, and you see, all right, you can help us out with administering exercise, and you can put hot packs, get ice bags, little things that students do at the high school or collegiate setting, but just expose them to what our realities are so that they can make that informed decision of, is this something I want to do? Or is it something that, no, I'd rather work in a clinical setting. I'd rather work rodeo like Sean does, or I really want to go professional sports. I just don't want AT students to not realize that this is an option. And I found it's a very difficult setting to get exposure to.
All right. So you mentioned in there you had a great mentor. So I want you to do two things. One, I want you to give a shout out to your mentor saying thank you. And then also you mentioned your dad is listening. So go ahead and give a shout out to him real quick.
Yeah. So my dad, Roddy Frazier, if you're listening back in Port Oxbury, hopefully you're enjoying the show. And my dad is a big fan of the podcast. He's been listening to them ever since I said I was doing this. So you have a fan for life there. My mentor, Tara Sutherland from St. FX University, she was the first one who kind of got me involved with this. And then Marty Bradley was my head athletic trainer when I was at Old Dominion, also a fantastic mentor. And then Chris Jones was a colleague of mine when I was a staff, but just she had 30 years of experience in the field. So those three people and everyone I've met along the way have been just fantastic. And what I find, those are the people, you always have some pivotal people in your career that are the ones that are responsible for getting you there. And those people all had a huge part in where I am today.
All right. So pick right back up again. You said your dad's name is Ronnie, right?
Roddy, R-O-D-D-I-E.
Roddy, thanks for listening, and I'm excited to have you on as a fan here at the show. So definitely, we're doing a listener spotlight coming up. So maybe I'll have you on next year as one of the listeners. You can just brag on your son some. So, okay, what is the most rewarding part of your job working with the athletes and performers of Cirque du Soleil?
I'd say just like what the reason why anyone really gets into this is the feeling that I get when somebody's coming back from an injury, the first time when they're on stage and I hear the crowd give them that applause that they deserve. It's a fascinating feeling to know that you've had a part to do. And I'm sure anyone who's been in any kind of health field feels the same way, that when you know that you've really contributed in a part of somebody's coming back from something, because anytime you've dealt with injury, there's so much more than just the physical. There's the mental side of it. There's the social side and the physical side. So we as ATs and anyone in this field, we're there for the whole thing from start to finish. So when I see that person go back and come off stage and give me a high five and know that they know what I've done to be part of that, that is an absolutely amazing feeling. And then the other thing just with doing this in general is getting the opportunity to do things like this, what we're doing today, like fantastic and meeting great people. Like I had an opportunity to meet Steve Antonopoulos from the Denver Broncos, like over 40 years. Steve Donahue from the New York Yankees. Like to sit and talk with guys like that who have been through like decades of people with some of the greatest athletes we've ever seen, and just to pick their brains, like that was as close as I've ever come to being starstruck, you know, because of what I know they've gone through, and to do it in a public forum. It's a great opportunity. It's just so rewarding to be able to call those guys colleagues and friends.
Chad, when you kind of go towards when you're talking about the different athletic trainers that you've seen, I know that you said when we were kind of walking around, one thing that you like to do is find the sports teams and find those different groups around. Kind of talk about that, would you? On your travels.
Absolutely. So the first time when I was on tour with my previous show, Amaluna, I didn't really think about that as an option. And then when I transferred to this show and I started, it was our medical contact when we were in Toronto. He was an AT as well. And now he served as our medical contact to help us find our doctors and everything. So he had asked me, he said, hey, are you a sports fan? I said, of course. Yeah, I know. I did this before I did Cirque. So he connected me with the head athletic trainer for the Toronto Raptors and the Toronto Maple Leafs. And when I met with them, I found that they were so just almost as intrigued as to what I do with Cirque, because they were like, wow, it's so cool that what you do. And I was like, well, wow, I'm a fan of yours. You know, I was here to visit you. But then they wanted to know more about what we did. So I started to realize that, wow, you know, ATs, we're all in the same bunch. We've all been in the trenches together with long hours and all that kind of stuff. So maybe there's more people that are interested in that kind of stuff. So I took it upon myself, because we were in major markets, to be able to say, well, hey, like connect with people. Are you interested in coming to see the show? See the backstage of what we do? And then it was always just that kind of an exchange. So I've done that with literally every city we've been in the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and MLB baseball. It's been fantastic. And just to have those type of contacts, and now anytime they're on the road, they're like, hey, I'm going to Vegas, or I see there's a show in town. I'm like, hey, let me connect you with them. And just to hear about their realities. Well, what kind of things do you do for concussions? What do you do for prevention? What kind of new things do you use? Because if there's anything we know, professional sports, they get the best of everything. So it really helps me to keep my ear to the ground of what's new and what kind of stuff they like, and then connect me with other people. And it's just been fascinating. And I'm so fortunate of all these guys that I grew up watching. And now when I see them on the sidelines, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, we hung out, and they're actually really, really good people. And just getting to meet some of the athletes, because they're intrigued as well too. Like when I spent time with Jason Biles with the Rockets, and James Harden was there. I'm like, hey, I'm James. I'm like, yeah, I know who you are. But I mean, super nice, super chill guy. And some of the guys wanted to come and see the show. So it's just great to share what we do. Because what I was telling Jeremy is that I've realized that a lot of people all over the world love Cirque du Soleil. So if I can help to share that and let people see what we do, then I'm more than happy to do that.
All right. You mentioned earlier you have an EAP, Emergency Action Plan. Have you ever had to stop a show for an injury? And then talk a little bit more about how you prepare for that, because like you said, it is the artistic director, it is a show, it is people paying. And so just talk about the whole process.
Yeah, no problem. So that's something, so our EAP program is something where I'm very, very proud of with Curious. Every show or kind of delegates how they choose to do so. For us on our show, we do our scenarios every 2 weeks. So we are always practicing show conditions where everyone's in costume and uniform for the technicians, the ones that help us out. I'll go into that in a second, with music, with lights, and we go through and we time it, we videotape it, so we can really have that learning. It's our job as therapists to design the EAPs for every potential scenario out there. That's one of the things that can be difficult. And Sean and I, we talked about this a little bit when you were there, that I need to be thinking about, well, what if they do this? And so we have something, if an artist goes into the audience, if they're on the stage, if they're backstage, anything like that, we have to be ready to have the response for that. We are the only medical professionals that are working in the show. So we utilize our technicians as our eyes and ears and our hands. So we are always at the head for any of our stuff to take for cervical stability. And then we have people that are help with our lift and slide, with our board, with our strapping, getting our oxygen, doing our splinting, anything like that. So we are kind of at the head, overseeing it, kind of quarterbacking it, so to speak. And then they do all of our stuff. And our technicians on our show, they're second to none, man. They are so great. Like we do it, and we take pride in knowing that we're going to be doing it at a high level. One of the reasons why we try to do have such a high standard is, in this age of technology, you see things online all the time that the minute something happens, people's cell phones are out and they're recording it. So we are confident enough that if something were to happen on our show, you're going to be and if somebody records something, it's going to be how it should be done. Because everybody knows their role, everybody does it, and we just go start to finish until we're there. Been super fortunate that we haven't had any showstoppers in my time. I have been on stage a couple of times for some things, but we're able to assess that and then have the show continue. So been very fortunate with that. The way it works with show business is much like how a referee calls you on. We have a general stage manager, and the stage is theirs until we are called. So if there's something that happens, I am waiting until I'm called on the stage, and then we make a decision, and everyone communicates on radio of what the plan is, and then we go into that. So we hold a standard that from the minute we're called on the stage until we are off the stage, we want to be off the stage in less than 8 minutes from start to finish, which if you've ever been to see anybody like carted off on a field, under 8 minutes, that's pretty impressive. So, and I think it's also one of the things that when you only have an X amount of people, like we only have six available bodies to help us, as opposed to if you see in a professional sports game, you might have like 12 or 15. When you have less cooks in the kitchen, everybody knows the role, everybody does it, and then we get out of there. So we've been very fortunate with that. And we do it all the time. We're always evolving it every time for what the needs are. And we invite the artists if they want to come and watch it. But a lot of artists are superstitious and they don't like to be part of it. They just know that it's there in case it's necessary.
So one of the things that you brought up with that was that one time you had to be up in the top. So even that is something that you have to think about and have an EAP for. And I mean, I can walking around there, I can't even imagine. You think about your EAP for your football field, your baseball field, your practice field, but like you literally have to have one for stage, off stage, inside of the little one of the balls, inside up on top of the net, up in the upper area, in the crowd. Like I can't even imagine the amount of EAPs that you have. And would you talk about like your safety precautions that you have to do with regard to being up there if you have to go up and evaluate somebody?
Yeah, so that's one of the when I came from the university, it's like you have for all the different fields, but at the end of the day, it's still a field. It's flat ground, right? You know. So the only difference would be if you had swimming and diving. But for us, once our stage is built and we know what the acts are going to be, then we have to say, all right, what could potentially happen? What do we need to be ready for? So what you're referring to is our grid. So where the artists load in from the top, we have to be ready to, if somebody has an injury or anything up there, we have to go up there. So our rigging group, which is responsible for all aerial safety, they certify my partner, myself, in fall protection training. We have our own harness that's ready to go right by the tunnel. So that instance you were talking about, there was an artist who had had an issue and was concerned while the show was going on. Her act was complete, so the show was still able to continue. I got the call, had to go up, so harness up, climb up in the dark, and do essentially an assessment in the dark. You know, have my little headlamp on, put it on the red light so it doesn't show up on the stage or anything. But we're 55 feet in the air in a 3-foot space, doing a quick little eval, and then realized that everything was okay. So we waited until intermission, and then we were able to bring her back down. But you just have to be ready for the unknown. And that's, again, it's one of the reasons why I love doing what I do, is I love that feeling of just not knowing what's going to happen every day, but being ready for it and being able to make a decision. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so much fun.
All right. So going back to, you talked about the internship that is again in its infancy. You mentioned having an athletic trainer doing some of the jobs that maybe a high school or college student athletic trainer would do. Is that something that high school students, like my high school students that were here, could come and do that backstage tour, kind of like you were talking about? Or is this really something you're only looking for like graduate level students?
Well, when I think of in the long term, if for a true internship route, I would think it would be geared towards somebody that really is, I want to gain more knowledge in performing arts because I really want to go in that direction. But for any high school or any college, I think it's a great opportunity to at least do a tour and see the space and see what's out there to get them thinking about it. If they're in a high school athletic training program, is this something maybe I want to go into college or university, knowing that this is an option? I think that's a great exposure for them, and I just want them to have that as an opportunity. But I do think that it would be geared more towards somebody that could serve more of a function of, okay, you have an understanding, a good, strong understanding of anatomy and exercise, therapeutic exercise and modalities, those kind of things is what I would envision of it in the long term.
Gotcha.
Something I want to ask with regard to your travel, because I know you brought this up, and this was one thing that you said was that, you know, you move back to Canada to be able to be close to family and to not be on the road all the time. Your dynamic of being on the road, though, it now is a lot different than what it was when you were in a college setting. And I know I've kind of moved into a position here where I'm on the road a little bit more. And how does that affect with your family? How does that affect your family time? How do you adjust for that for somebody that, let's say, wants to go into CERC or wants to go into something like that where, you know, you're gone, you're in one city for 7 weeks and then in another city for, and it's not like you get 3 weeks home in between it, you go straight on. Yeah. How do you approach that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And to be honest, it's a conversation that everybody has to have individually with those people that they care about the most. So like you said, the plan was when I was getting back, I moved to Montreal with my wife, Dina. Hello, babe, if you're watching. To be closer to the family. So I was working at the headquarters. And then, like I had said before, that all of a sudden this opportunity came to tour again, which was similar to what I had done in the past where, you know, you're on the road a lot. But even in the collegiate setting, you know, you're gone for a game, but then you always come back home. That's not the case here. So my wife and I, we had a discussion and I said, look, what do you think about this opportunity? I think it's great. I want to try to see what it's like. And we both love to travel. So we said, we're going to try and see how it works out. With that, touring life is not for everybody because like I was telling you, so my the house that I have in Montreal, last year I spent 7 weeks total for the entire year of 2016. I mean, that's not common and it's not ideal. I'd love to be at my house more, but this is the nature of the job that I chose. But the opportunities of getting to see parts of the world and learn things in cultures in different areas, that type of life learning, you can't learn that from a book. And that's something that I really think just bodes well and really helps to shape me as a better human. My wife is really encouraging of that. She loves to see all the cities that we go to and experience that. And it's something that we do together. And we also communicate a lot too. Like, I don't think I'd be good at this job if I wasn't able to communicate well with my artists and the people that I need to. And I certainly wouldn't be able to have a successful marriage if I wasn't able to communicate well. So, you know, we use Skype, FaceTime, anything like that. We're on the phone all the time, making sure that we are keeping in touch with our needs. And then also when we are together at home or once we visit, we spend really good quality time together doing things together. And I think that keeps that balance of doing something that is difficult and being on the road, but also doing something that you love. And it's a question that I ask all the head ATs of, like, in the NFL, when they're constantly on the phone and always on the road and busy. And they're like, yeah, you just have to have a good understanding group of people in your corner. And I've been very fortunate. Like, my sister, Natalie, my parents, Roddy and DeSilla, and my wife, Dina, like, that's my core circle. And they all know that I love what I do and that it's brought me some amazing experiences. And they all are a fantastic support structure, and I'm very, very grateful for that.
You mentioned that your wife gets to come to all of the cities. How does that work out, and I guess how often is she there, and how well or how long does she get to stay when she comes to see you?
Yeah, so I always joke that my wife uses our tour plan like a catalog, that she looks and she finds all the cities that she loves, and she just comes and plans her vacations accordingly. So we usually spend between, like I said, 6 to 10 weeks, on average, usually 8 weeks in a city. So about the halfway point, we usually get what's called a double dark. So we're off Monday and Tuesday. So she usually will try to plan her vacation times to come visit me around that time, where we usually will have 3 or 4 days together in the city, and she'll come and watch the show, hang out backstage, get to know and just hang out with the artists because she knows them so well. And then we explore the city. So we try to do that every time in the middle of a city. And then I almost always will go home in between those cities. So we're in our final week of Houston, and I'll be heading back to Montreal to spend the week with her then.
And that is that the travel time that they're moving on to the next facility?
Yeah. So generally, and when you're in the North American tour anyway, we have 1 week off in between all of our cities. And then once a year, we have what's called an annual leave. That's a 2 week break. For that, the company will send everybody to their home address for 2 weeks. And then they will fly them to the next city as well. So we had that after Miami to start the 2017 year, and then we won't have it until the end of 2017.
Very cool.
All right. So one thing we haven't discussed at all is pay, right? I don't think that in an NATA survey, a Cirque du Soleil athletic trainer is well represented. I'm not quite sure, but obviously here in Texas, you know, I'm okay with saying how much I make. I make $68,000 a year. This is my 13th year as a professional. How do you guys rank? You know, I think NFL is probably the top in the pay scale, but how do you guys rank there?
I would say as an AT, we rank quite high.
Yeah.
In looking at it, and I did my part to answer the salary survey to do it with performing arts. I put it as professional performing arts because I want people to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. They do a very good job of taking good care of us. So a lot of people are in the high range and approaching and some over six figures with that. So I know that that's it's great. Like and the way that I look at it is that I think ATs all around like work very hard, and I think a lot of are underpaid. So the way that Cirque has kind of looked at it is that, look, we're going to pay you well, and with that comes responsibility. And I'm okay with that responsibility. I take that on. I don't think that's any less responsibility than any AT in any setting takes on. But I think that when you know that you're getting that financial compensation, you take it quite seriously. And you're like, well, they're going to pay me. I need to make sure I'm on top of my game. So I think that performing arts is definitely, at least with Cirque du Soleil, and I can't speak to how it is on other circus companies or other performing arts, but with Cirque du Soleil, I am quite well happy with how they compensate me. And we also, I mean, we have our food is taken care of. We have cooks that travel with us. They give me a phone. So I have very little expenses when I'm on the road as well. So while they pay you well, they also travel us and everything. If I choose to rent a car or do anything like that, that's out of my own pocket. But they will they'll take us from city to city and give us everything that we can to be able to be successful. So, and they're really trying to do that to retain good people. So, you know, there's about, you know, between 36 and 40 of us in all over the world. So if they are viewing that we are high level professionals, they know that, well, if you want to keep those people, you have to compensate them well. So the company has done a good job of trying to continue to bump up our compensation. And I think it's retaining quality talent.
All right. So you're going to hire a new athletic trainer to work with you. What are some of the things that you're really looking for?
Absolutely. So to me, two things. The soft skills are going to be number one. You need to be a very, very good human. You need to be a good person, good communication, and adaptable. Because like we were talking about, Sean and Jeremy too, things can change so quickly. Like, you have to be able to be like, okay, well, it's not going to work today. Something's going to be different. Can you deal with that stressful situation? From a clinical side of things, you need to be great with your hands. And that's what I think is something that is sometimes can be lost a little bit in AT, that some we can be so quick to want to add tools and like different things. I want to do this, I want to do that. That's great. But at the end of the day, your hands have to be your best tools, because humans want that touch of knowing that, all right, you can feel what I'm feeling and you can help to fix it. Tools can absolutely supplement that thing, but at the end of the day, you have to have a good set of hands to know that, because you can't have all these different things because you have to travel them as well. And Sean, you saw how small our space was. Things have to be in trunks and cases. So I'd love to have a lot of stuff, but the being adaptable and being good with your hands are like the two big, big things. So what I would tell students is if performing arts is something that you may be interested in, look at working with sports like gymnastics, track and field. And the reason why those I like those is track and field have a lot of different body types. You have some of your big throwers, you have your steeplechase, you have your sprinters, your jumpers, and just get your hands on them, like massage, feel how different Achilles feel how different shoulders feel, because that's really going to be, like when I look at all my 46 artists, 46 different body types. And what works for one person is never going to work for another. So the more people you get your hands on, then the more that mental Rolodex you have of like, oh, okay, yeah, I remember this, how this felt with this person. And then you can kind of apply that to that. Like, nothing ever feels like it is in a textbook. And I remember that was the biggest thing when I first started doing this. But the more people that you get your hands on, and the more you use colleagues and just people that you meet, it's going to put you in a position to potentially be in this field.
All right. Sean works at a recovery center right now at AOKC. Mm-hmm. And so as Sean was talking about, that guy is like squatting, doing kettlebell swings. Normally people don't do workouts like that every day. They do them every other day or maybe every third day, that kind of thing. So what are some of the things that you do or your athletes do for recovery from an intense workout, which is their performance?
Yeah. Well, we try to have them do a lot of just more active recovery. A lot of them just like to walk around the city. I don't want them to just completely stay still. I always encourage anybody to use your body, move, just keep moving. A lot of them will, I'll encourage them to swim. I really push a lot of spa recovery. So on their days off, they'll go do a dry sauna, do some cold tubs and do that back and forth, like jacuzzi, just to let their bodies recover. And a lot of them, some of them have families and they'll just walk around and explore the city. But I also tell them, well, don't walk for 15 miles, you know, because they're not used to that. You know, use your body, move up, sit a little bit. But some of the guys, like the guys that we talked about with the CrossFit, they just love to train. So on their days off, they're going to really push it hard on that day, knowing that they're just going to taper off when they're in more of their performance. So every body is different. And it goes back to knowing your athlete and your artist. My suggestion for an acronet artist that loves to do a lot of high intensity stuff will be different than from the contortionist. The contortionist will all just have, all right, get your body moving a little bit, but do a little bit of stretching, but just active recovery, not to do anything too intense. But another thing is, because they've been on tour for so long and they're veterans, they know their bodies. You know, a lot of them will say, well, I was thinking about doing this. What do you think? Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Or, oh, well, maybe, you know, you had a bit of a long week. Maybe let's not, you know, walk around the zoo for 4 hours. You know, it's going to be, you know, almost 95 degrees. Let's not do that. And they're like, oh yeah, I didn't think about that. Because they're just thinking of, I just want to do something to get my mind out of it, get my mind fresh. But we also have to take care of their bodies because they only have that one day to recover. And then we're right back to the grind again.
What with that, what do you use? Is there anything, like, what would be the number one or two thing that you use that's maybe new or, you know, something that you do, not maybe only for recovery, but treatment, other than, you know, we talked about hands, just using mm-hmm. manual therapies. And I mean, I think both utilize a lot of manual therapy, but is there something big out right now that you're utilizing?
Well, for us, we use the Normatec, and I just like that for an active, for recovery. And I let the artists kind of just use it whenever they want. I'm a big fan of the Game Ready, but what I found is that a lot of the artists, especially like Eastern European artists, they're not a huge fan of icing at times. So I'm not going to force somebody to ice if they really just don't like it. Again, it goes back to, they know their bodies. They've been doing it a long time. Who am I to change what they've been doing? So at one point, I decided, well, at least the compression therapy is really good to help the recovery of the legs. We also try to push a lot of just myofascial self-care. We use a lot of the release balls and the Theracane, any kind of foam rollers, just for them to really get the feel of what their bodies, where their tensions are, and how they can release them themselves. I think dry needling has a huge place in recovery as well. My partner and I are looking into potentially doing that for our next round of continuing education. I think if you have anybody on staff or anybody that you can outsource to do that, I think that has shown a lot of good success. And I'm seeing that as kind of a really important trend. We also do some cupping as well, just to work that negative pressure to just kind of complement the positive pressure of the release that we do. And some artists love cupping. Some, they don't even like it because they just don't like the look of the skin pulling up like that. So, all right, it's not for you. But we've seen some good success with that. So what I try to tell the artist is that if there's something that you really think that you'd benefit from, I will do everything I can to get that and facilitate it to support you. Because I think another thing that sometimes ATs can do is they think that they have a template of, well, no, this is what everyone's going to get. And I think that that's a wrong way of pigeonholing that all right, we're always going to do this set of exercises for everything. You really have to just be willing to be open and learn from your athletes. You can give them the knowledge that you have. And I tell that my artist that, look, you know, I studied a lot for this and this is what I think. Let's have a discussion. If the artists love to know that it's not just me saying, well, this is what we're doing. I'll say, this is what I think. What are your thoughts? And we'll have a discussion. And then sometimes they're like, but I really want this. Okay, well, I'm cool with that. Let's do that. If it works, fantastic. If it doesn't, now maybe we'll try it this way. And that's how you get that buy-in. That if it's everything, well, no, it's my way or the highway, then you're going to have that defensive and you're taking a position. I just never really thought that worked out very well. So if you're open to different ideas and different possibilities, I'm all for it. Sometimes artists will say, oh, I want to go and get a chiropractic treatment. Okay, no problem. Go ahead. That's not something that we do. But if you want to do that, go ahead and you can do that and we'll support it. So we really try to encourage the artist to do a lot of self-care.
All right, completely off topic. Right. Being a world traveler, my wife likes food. We went to San Francisco, as you mentioned, and she had one of those sourdough bowls with clam chowder, right? So it's really popular in San Francisco.
Absolutely.
So where are the places that you would go and pay for food rather than eat what's provided for you?
Well, the good thing about it is that every Monday, that's our day off, so our kitchen, everything is closed. So every Monday is the day that you're on your own for food. So most of the time, if I'm working the show, I'm there from, you know, 2 until 11, so I can't go out. Mm-hmm. If I'm working an early shift, like I'm there for the first training, and I'll leave when the first show starts at 8 o'clock, then I might be able to go and do that. I'll always do that when my wife is in town, because she always wants to experience something like that. She's much more of a foodie than I am. She will eat anything, and I'm sure she's probably rolling her eyes right now, because I'm a very bland, picky eater, so I'm like, I'm very simple. So, but I'll try to encourage her to go and try to do some different things, because she loves to experience that. But yeah, just like you said, like she wanted to try the clam chowder in a bowl when we were in San Francisco at Pier 39.
Yep.
And then, you know, when you're in Miami, we went to a Cuban restaurant. So we try to just expose ourselves to what is big in the area, mm-hmm. and see what's out there. And she's usually much more happy than I am, because I'm like I said, I'm as vanilla as they get.
All right. So on that, have you had any barbecue since you've been here?
I had a little bit when we were in Dallas before, but not since I've been in Houston. It's been because we're a little bit more outside of the city, it hasn't been as easy to go into that area. But I'll eat it. I'm not a huge barbecue fan. I don't want to get thrown out of Texas for saying that. But it's my wife had it, and she's a big fan. She loves ribs, and she's a big fan of that.
All right. Well, I can definitely recommend some afterwards, but very cool. It's just fun to hear the different stories. People obviously are a completely different lifestyle than me. We're here. We have three kids. And again, that's something you mentioned that you guys mutually talked about, decided y'all aren't having kids. And so, you know, that's something there. Do you, any of the athletic trainers that, or therapists that work with you guys have kids?
There are some. It's there's not a whole lot. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't believe that there are any that have kids on tour. Because right now, a lot of the therapists are, they're single or in long-term relationships, but I don't think that there's a lot of kids involved, and I'd have to really think about that. But again, touring life, it works for some people, and some people are just like, I don't really want to do it. The company is really great about supporting if you have family on tour. It's great. They'll help to travel with you. The employee is responsible for paying to get those people to those places, and they have to live in the same accommodations that we have, but the company will help with any kind of visa, immigration, anything like that. They'll help and travel them. So they're really, really good about making people enjoy the tour life.
All right. So if I say I'm going to retire here in 15 years, right? Yeah. If I wanted to come and work with Cirque du Soleil, am I basically out of, you know, if I'm 55 years old, am I out of the loop? I'm not an option?
Absolutely not. No, I think anybody is. As long as if you have the skills and you have the desire to do it at any age, you can do it. I think the reason why it's more for a younger population is because of the lifestyle of touring. That if people want to start a family and they want to be closer to whether they're grandparents or their relatives, that's not easy to do all the time. But absolutely, people can do it. And there are some people that have done it for a long time. There's one guy who'd been on tour forever. He's in his mid to late 40s, and he just transferred to Las Vegas to be more permanent. But he toured for a long time, really enjoyed it. So everybody has their own feelings of how they want to do it. Even myself, I'm not sure. I always tell my wife and my friends that I'll do it until I just no longer enjoy it as much. You know, when the negative things start to outweigh the positive things, all right, it's time to make a change and do something different. But anybody is capable of doing it. If anyone is ever interested, searchdusoleil.com/ I think it's jobs, or on the website, you can apply. You can put your resume in the bank. I always suggest that people try to connect with therapists that are in the company. If it's something that you think that you want to do, LinkedIn is a good idea. I mean, people are on Instagram, Facebook. And then if you know that there's a show in town and you don't have any of those resources, you can just go to the site, just talk to security and say, hey, can you leave my business card or a message to the therapist? I just want them to contact me. I've had people do that. And if it's a credible person that doesn't seem like they're crazy, because there have been a couple of crazies, then I'll always reach out and be like, hey, you know, what are your thoughts? What are you interested in? And I'll try to do what I can to make myself available. Like I said, it all comes down to try to be a good ambassador for the profession, because when you've had good people that have helped you along the way, I want to do my part. And if I can make somebody, you know, I guess excited or enthralled with this profession, I'm all for that.
I know that one thing, anytime that the NATA national meeting is in Vegas, they always offer up Cirque tickets. I believe they do a discount on tickets, and I believe the last time there was actually a Cirque du Soleil open forum asking questions, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool. It was really interesting to be out there. I didn't go to one of the performances when we were out there for NATA, but I know that one's coming up, I believe, here in the next couple of years. I can't quite remember which one or what year. Obviously, we're in Houston here this year, but mm-hmm. I've always thought that was cool. And once in a while, you'll actually see them on the job boards there on the NATA's website in the Career Center, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great, especially when it's in Vegas, because a lot of people, when they go to Vegas, they associate, like, you know, you see O, you know, Ka, all those things. They some people associate that experience with Cirque du Soleil, of being on the Vegas Strip. So I think it's great to know that this is an option. And if when the convention is there, like I was able to make it to the convention once when I first started on tour, I would have loved to have been part of something like that, just to let people know that this is what I do. And if you're interested, I'll talk to anybody for days that are interested in it. You know, I never want to be a person who stands up there on a soapbox and like, oh, and we do this and I do that. But if somebody has a genuine interest, sure, pick my brain anytime. I'm more than available to do so, because I just think that the more information people have, then the more informed they are to make a decision of, is this something I'd like, or is this something, no, I'd rather stick with my sports. To each their own.
All right, so coming back to your comment about track and field experience, Adam Kay, who was watching live on YouTube, said that he couldn't agree more with the statement there about track and field, just how the different body types and that kind of stuff. So, Adam, thanks for listening and commenting there. Chad, I know you said business card is a good way if somebody hands it to security, or I guess like last ditch effort. But if somebody wants to get a hold of you, again, I was kind of bragging on you at the beginning, just how willing to share and talk and just excited about what you do. So how is somebody going to get a hold of you?
Yeah. So, you could share my Instagram and my Twitter. I'm not on social media as much, like posting as much stuff. My sister gets on me all the time. She said I should be posting more because she's like, you have one of the coolest jobs. So I'm going to try to get better at that. But you can you can email me, chad.frazier@cirquedusoleil.com. And what I tell people is that I will always try to get back to you in a timely manner, but I'm also, there's a lot of stuff going on. We're quite busy with a lot of stuff, but anything, if you write me an email and you're respectful and you're professional with how you write something, I will do everything I can to get back to you and see what I can do. I've made myself available to students if they've had to do like an interview of somebody in a different setting, or a student that just wants to know more about it. I will always work with my schedule to try to make something work if I can. And if it's a bad time of the year, I'll always be honest and say, just give me a couple days or a couple weeks. But I've been pretty consistent with everyone that has reached out to me that I'll make time for you.
And not just that, you said you can connect them with a therapist. So if somebody's in a different region where there's a show, you can say, yeah, here, let me forward this on to so-and-so.
Absolutely. And so because there's so few of us that do this, I am connected with all the therapists, the full-time therapists within the company. So let's say if somebody is in, oh, there's a show in Denver. Hey, do you know the person there? Absolutely, I'll know them and I can forward them the information. But what I can't guarantee is that they are as eager to work with students or do that. So I don't want everyone to think that just because I make myself available that everyone does, because people have different priorities and whatever they want. So I just wouldn't want somebody to be let down that somebody didn't get back to them. But I would do my part of letting a person know who it is. And if I would try to also connect with that therapist and say, hey, by the way, this person kind of contacted me. And then it kind of goes back to that. If you send me a message and you're professional and you kind of let me know what your goals are and what you're thinking, I can then go to bat for you a little bit more too with that therapist. I'm like, look, this person, they're really interested. They're super keen. They have this kind of experience. I think this is somebody that could be, you know, one of our colleagues someday, you know, as opposed to, hey, there's a show in Denver. I want to meet the person. You know, it's a fine line between somebody who's interested in the profession and somebody who just wants to be a super fan and wants to see the artist up close backstage. So, you know, we do want to make sure you weed out the people that really are interested in this, because those are the people that I really want to help, that feel like they don't have anywhere to turn and just want that little foot in the door. And maybe that could be a great clinician and it could have a great career in this field.
Very good. Sean, final questions?
I just want to echo kind of what you had said about how awesome. And I want to thank you, Chad, for everything, because, I mean, it was probably – I could have probably been taken as one of those weirdos to think for walking up to you and being like, hey, I have an idea. Can we try to sit down and talk about on a podcast? So it was really cool that my group here at AOKC, they kind of sent us up there and let us get to watch it, man. It was awesome. My questions, I have two questions for you. One, the Russian, what's it called?
Russian Cradle?
The Russian Cradle. How much does that guy deadlift? Because that was the one thought that I had when I was watching it. I was like, I know he's got to be huge numbers. So, and that's also the meathead in me. And two, I've got handstand walks down. How do I get into the single arm handstand just hold? I like that was the coolest thing too. That's awesome.
That's it's very impressive. So I'm working on my handstand, just a hold. I don't have the walk yet, so you got one up on me there, so well done. So the first question, deadlift. We've never actually tested his true deadlift, but at one point I've seen him deadlift 315, so that's 345s in each side, and he did it. To say it was easy would be an understatement. So we've never truly loaded up the bar with some bands to see how much he could do, but I would easily think it could be well over 4 bills for sure. So, but he can do 315. Like, he weighs about 230 pounds, and his back and hips are some of the strongest that I've ever worked on in my career. And I've worked on some pretty strong football players, but just because of the repetitiveness of what he does is just unreal. Like, his lower half and his core is so, so strong and powerful. So I'm going to ask him, and if I get an update number, I will, I'll message you and you can do a little update on there. So to answer about the handstands. So if you're up against a wall, what I would do is that you just kind of, you get on that one handstand. So have you been doing like the shoulder touches as well with that?
Yeah, I've been working on it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you just kind of like spread the legs a little bit, and then you have to kind of lean your body weight over to the side because your shoulder needs to take that weight, but your center of gravity has to move off to the side to be able to do that. I make it sound like it's super easy. I can't even do it, but that's the progression that I've seen. Because the guy that does the handstand, he does workshops and stuff, and he makes it look so easy. Like, he could do it for, he could be there like that for hours. It's quite impressive. So that's a little tidbit that I'll give you with that.
It was insane. No, it was really cool to watch. I really enjoyed, and as well as getting to know you and just kind of chat with you that real quick time back there. So that, I really appreciate all of that.
No, it's my pleasure. I'm glad. Another thing, just to tell any of the students that, like, I'm glad you took the initiative to talk to me about that, because if you just didn't say anything, we wouldn't have been able to have this opportunity and maybe reach somebody that, you know, is interested in this kind of thing. So I love when somebody takes that initiative of like, I'm interested in this. I want to know. So that's why I make myself available. There are no excuses. Send the message and put it in my court and let me get back to you whenever I can. So I'm glad that you spoke to me, and this has been a fantastic experience, and I really appreciate you guys inviting me here. It's been fantastic.
Definitely a talker. Chad knows his stuff, highly intelligent, very personable. So it was really cool. I could see, like, when we were texting back and forth, you were excited. I know Sean was excited. And, you know, like I said, me and Sean have been trying to do this. So it was a really cool conversation. And I'm super glad that you did make yourself available, and it just happened to be on one of your off days. So
my pleasure.
Again, thank you. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/circ. I have the links to Chad's stuff, and of course, you know, Sean Reedy _ATC on Twitter and Instagram, I believe, but just search for Sean, spelled like Reddy. So just search for him, and you can connect there with Sean, or again, I got this stuff for Chad on social media. You could at least follow him, reach out to him that way, and then start building the communication. On Twitter, I am Mr. Jeremy Jackson, but the easiest way is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. And again, this one is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/circ. So for Jeremy, Sean Reedy, and Mr. Chad Frazier, that is a wrap.